You don't recognize this song or artist, that's Charlie Robison. He's known as a country artist, but as you can tell from this tune here, he's not so easily categorized. The name of the song is Yellow Blues from 2009. That's a pretty good song. We're talking with Bill Friedman, a casino consultant and author. His new book, 30 Illegal Years to the Strip, is a massive undertaking. More than 500 interviews were conducted by Bill as he worked on this project for more than 40 years, and it really shows. And some of the people he talked to face-to-face are some of the folks who are featured in the book, people like Jimmy Blue Eyes, Vincent Allo, one of the most influential mob figures in the history of the American Mafia. We're going to talk about him, as well as Ben Siegel, a little bit more about Mo Dalitz, right after this on Coast to Coast. Bill Friedman, I should tell you, when I first got to Las Vegas, it was the late 70s. It was a really interesting time in the history of the mob, the things that were going on there. Just by sheer luck, by coincidence, some of the first people I met turned out to be mob guys. I didn't know they were mob guys at the time. It was before I was a journalist, and then later, after I became a reporter, I realized who they were, and I had already established a relationship with them, so they would tell me things. Now, I couldn't use any of that stuff in the stories, but it would give me perspective and help me fill in the blanks, kind of, as long as I did not violate a confidence. One of those people is still around. He's a name you would recognize, but it sort of goes back to what you were saying in the first hour about how investigative reporters in different cities would develop relationships with these mob guys and would help them understand how things operated. And yet, even though you relied on all these thousands of newspaper stories, it still becomes an inaccurate picture when you look at the totality of what is reported, what is printed, and the legends that grow up around these fellows, right?
Absolutely. Now, if I hadn't had the interviews, I, as you said, would have lacked perspective on some stories, and there were actually stories and even court cases, lawsuits, I should say, different from criminal cases, that I got lots of data, couldn't make heads or tails out of what was really happening, and until I got the interviews, there was a side story going on that was the real conflict. And until you had that, then everything fit. You understood everything. But no, that's why I used every source I could get, document-wise and interview-wise, before I tried to draw any conclusions.
I mentioned at the beginning of the program, and I'll sidestep this for a moment. We'll come back to Mo Dalitz, but your background, I think I'm right in saying you're the only guy in the history of Las Vegas who managed two different strip casinos at the same time, both of them very successful. Is that right?
Yes. We know a number of companies have owned multiple casinos, but nobody has ever managed more than one, and I was the only one.
Silver Slipper and Castaways, both of them were like institutions on the Strip. Both of them, I sure miss both of them. There's nothing like it left in the day of the mega resort.
Well, I learned my lessons well. Remember, I was studying under the greatest gambling operators in history, and so when I was given the chance, which is unbelievable, my goal was to do my research, and I had never managed anyone, supervised anyone, and one day I was offered the presidency of a hotel casino, and that was quite remarkable.
And the reason you got the job is because of recommendations from two of the names that we're talking about tonight, Benny Binion and Mo Dalitz.
Yes, I applied, and they've both been long-term losers, and the company was a very, very straight company, did everything properly, and they told me up front, we've had the best names we could find to try to turn these around. They couldn't do it. You're an experiment. You're teaching at the university. You've done all this research, but we don't know if you can do it. But we're telling you now, if you don't turn them around, we will fire you. And 3 months after I took over the Castaways, and that was the first time they said, we're thinking about giving you another one, they were so pleased. I very quickly took them from big-time losers to good profit makers. They said, actually, you're making a profit bigger than we even thought they could make. And they said, we think you should know who your friends are. And they said, when you applied, you gave us 5 references. They were fine professional people. They were good character references. But we knew they knew nothing about the gambling industry to recommend or judge you. So we went to the 2 biggest gangsters in town, and that actually surprised me, because this was the era in which Howard Hughes fronted for the CIA in, like, the Glomar Explorer, which was the huge ocean-going vessel.
Right.
And they did everything very properly, and they demanded that I do it. Up front, they told me, we have huge government contracts. If you do anything wrong, you can cost us more money than you could make back in a lifetime. Do everything properly. And I did it, and so I was with them till they got out of the business. But they said, we think you should know who your friends are. And they said, so we went to the 2 people that know the most about gambling, and they are the 2 biggest gangsters in town, Mo Dalitz and Benny Binion. They said, we have had tens of thousands of applicants. We are the biggest private corporation in the world, and we think you should know that Benny Binion gave you the best reference we have ever had on anyone, and Mo Dalitz was one step behind him. So I ended up in the odd situation of not only doing research on the gangsters, but this incredible professional, legitimate career I ended up with, they were directing that too.
Amazing that only in Las Vegas could the recommendation from 2 notorious, I guess in some circles, notorious gangster figures be a plus for your career. I should mention the Howard Hughes Corporation, Summa Corporation, is who you worked for, and that was the beginning of sort of corporate interests in Las Vegas, moving the mob out, moving the corporations in. But during that era, of course, as we now know, there was a lot of skimming still going on. Did anyone ever come to you and say, yeah, you're doing a great job, but you can make a lot more money if you help us out, do something shady?
That never happened. My guess is where a investigative reporter or a psychiatrist, psychologist, asks questions but doesn't pass out personal opinion. They're out to get the information. I got to know these guys, and I was very candid when I agreed, disagreed. I had a hard time in the beginning because we were looking at history, things that happened 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and I had always thought the Constitution and the law was concrete, and I was surprised to find that judicial decisions change over time based on the same laws and clauses in the Constitution. And I had to learn not what was going on in my era, but how it was thought of, why it was thought of. And I think in discussing these issues, it became pretty clear that I was coming from a very straight point of view. So nobody ever offered me anything that wasn't legitimate.
We were talking about Mo Dalitz, and he was sort of a godfather figure in Las Vegas. As you describe in meticulous detail in your book, he was sort of one of the founding fathers of what became known as organized crime in America, one of the pillars of that organization. But not, he was never characterized as sort of one of the bloodthirsty guys, certainly not like an Al Capone. You draw a distinction between the good hoods and the bad hoods, even at that level. Talk about it a little bit.
Okay, well, the main theme of the book is that the 4 largest Prohibition gangs ended up 30 years after Prohibition started, building 80% of the hotels, gambling resorts on the Strip for the 2 decades from the opening of the Flamingo in 1946 to the opening of Caesar's Palace in 1966. So this traces who these gangs were, and it covers their 30 years on the way to the Strip. And the first 14, of course, was Prohibition, and the next 16, they branched out, these four gangs, across the country, and they built and operated incredibly elegant, high-end casinos. They were usually fronted by the best nightclub or the best restaurant in their locale, and they had the gambling behind it. And so this is those 30 years. It's actually about organized crime as it actually was and has never been presented, but it also is very glamorous because they were bringing in the finest and most expensive liquors in the world and then operating these incredible gambling facilities. So the three gangs that to me were the most important and had the biggest influence on the Strip and in Prohibition, they were not gangsters historically. They weren't in street crimes and that sort of thing. They went in for the profits. They fought like businessmen. And those three gangs had seven leaders, and this is the stories of them. And they were a different breed. They, as I mentioned real early, they were gamblers, involved in any form of organized crime, and all seven of them individually, that's why they came together so strongly, had the same belief. They opposed violence except in self-defense. They opposed vendetta, and they opposed monopoly. If they went into an area and they bribed the law and the prosecutors and the judges and the politicians and opened up gambling, instead of saying, this is our territory, they'd call up the other top gangs and say, y'all come in, let's compete. They were a completely different breed. They did the same thing in Vegas. They dominated, but anyone else wants to come in, that's fine. So they were the guys that I was so close to, that I admired so much. What is unbelievable, the fourth gang, and by the way, I present Prohibition like it never has been because no one ever had this information before. They were so big, these three gangs, compared to anybody else. But where most people were making moonshine, they brought in the most expensive liquors from all over the world at a massive quantity. We're talking about many tens of millions of bottles a year. So you've got these guys that basically come out of poor economics, getting into finance, buying all this liquor, having oceanic freighters come to the international waterline, then having a fleet of high-speed boats load up, take it to shore. As soon as they left the boats, the Coast Guard took after them. Pirate ships were waiting in the darkness. They'd get to shore, load up on a huge convoy of trucks, and from there on, they were watching for hijackers hiding in ambush, and this is how they moved all of this liquor. But what's amazing, these three groups that stood for a legitimate ways to do illegal things partnered the entire time with the most murderous gang of all, the Capone gang out of Chicago. On paper, they should have had nothing in common. Capone loved them. The most psychopathic gang leader of the time was Albert Anastasia. He loved them. They always backed them politically in the underworld and the overworld. They partnered, not Anastasia, but Capone and his successors. They partnered in Prohibition. They partnered, they built these four gangs. At the end of Prohibition, all of a sudden there's this huge demand and no distilleries. And they built the biggest distillery in the history of the United States, and they did everything legitimately except one thing. They put false tax stamps on the bottles and didn't pay the tax. But because this was headed by the legitimate guys and not Capone, who wanted the biggest profit, they passed that savings on, and 2 decades before Walmart opened, they were selling the cheapest booze in America. Yes, it was as good as anything being made, and they totally dominated the field across the country. Well, they went into the gambling business, and these four gangs were unique in one way that they all shared. Every gang in America was basically one nationality. They came from a neighborhood where it was primarily one nationality. They all belonged to it, and they remained within their territorial boundaries. And after Prohibition, they stayed and committed crimes against their fellow countrymen. These four gangs branched out across the country. They went into areas that never were opened up to gambling. They bribed the people, and then they brought everybody in. And so this is that story of how that happened. So when they get to Vegas, you find all nationalities involved in this business. And what is incredible, because I lived it, I experienced it, you never found in a hotel here in Vegas or even downtown the casinos one nationality in a place. It was always multiple nationalities. Everybody enjoyed the differences, shared it, and grouped together time after time after time.
I was surprised in your characterization of, for example, Lucky Luciano, who was one of these guys, Meyer Lansky, who was so important to the development of Las Vegas, that, you know, you get the idea of Luciano, who sort of a model for Vito Corleone, that he was a killer, bloodthirsty. He wouldn't bat an eye at taking somebody out. But in the book that you portray, he, Lansky, Jimmy Blue Eyes, they had muscle, of course. They had to have it, but that they tried to avoid violence where they could.
And they really objected to it. There wasn't anybody that I dealt with that if you threatened, they wouldn't kill and kill quickly. Okay, these were tough men, and they'd lived in a very tough gang world. But all of them preached against it. Luciano, when he was the lieutenant in the biggest mafia gang in America, and he only joined because they controlled Manhattan, and that was the market he wanted for his liquor, because Manhattan had over half the wealthy people in America living in it. And so he had to join and become the lieutenant and turn over part of his profits to the godfather. He did something that is absolutely unprecedented in the history of American crime. After the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, in which Capone killed 7 members in a competing gang and just shocked the nation, Luciano called all the top gang leaders in America and said, "I want to have a meeting in Atlantic City." And this is the only time in history anyone has brought together all the gangs of all nationalities. He brought them in. He was a lieutenant only. I mean, the respect he commanded was beyond anything anybody's ever had in the underworld as a lieutenant. They all showed up. He said, "This violence has to stop. We are heroes to America. We are supplying a need. But all this killing is turning the public against us. And soon the police and the politicians are going to turn with them. And then we're going to lose our businesses and go to jail." And at the moment that I think is the most incredible moment in the history of organized crime in terms of Vegas.
I'll tell you what, Bill, we're going to pick it up on the other side. Hold that thought. Our conversation with Bill Friedman is getting pretty good here. Stick around. Much more to come. Traveling Wilburys take us into the break. That's Emmylou Harris belting out a song, Ooh, Las Vegas, co-written by the late Graham Parsons. And Las Vegas, as we've been learning, is the sort of the culmination, the pinnacle of all the work that was done by the founding members of organized crime during Prohibition. They took that money after booze became legal and moved into gambling and created Las Vegas. And for a while there, for decades, in fact, the rule was no violence, no killing in Las Vegas. It's an open city. Everybody can compete, but we don't want anything that's going to endanger the Golden Goose, so take it somewhere else. That changed, though. That changed in the late 70s, and things got bad, and it led to some major changes. We're going to get into that and talk more with my guest, Bill Friedman, in our final segment with him right after this on Coast to Coast. Bill Friedman, before the break, you're telling about this incredible moment when Lucky Luciano sort of lays down the law to every other organized crime organization in the country at that meeting in Atlantic City and says, knock it off, basically. And I think in your book, you describe the what happened is that Al Capone, who was sort of the troublemaker at the time, went along with it. He got the message, right?
Yes. In an incredible moment from the point of view of Vegas, Capone sitting facing three men. One was Luciano, who headed the biggest Prohibition gang. The next one was Frank Costello, who was number two. And the third was Mo Dalis, who was number three. And they said, you have to stop this. And he agreed. And they said, you have to do something to show us, not just tell us and go back and do it, because they didn't want to start a war with him after the fact. So he came with a proposal. They accepted it. And he left that meeting. He drove with his bodyguard 60 miles to Philadelphia. He walked into a movie theater where there were two detectives, which it was later proven he knew, walked up to one of them and said, I'm carrying a gun, and pulled it out and handed it to him. And the detective took him in, and the next morning they went into court, and his attorney started to complain because it was an illegal seizure, and he just told his attorney to shut up, pled guilty, and nobody in the in Philadelphia had ever received more than a $300 fine for a concealed weapon. He got the full year, served it. The press right away knew something was wrong. I describe it in my book, all the things that this never would have happened unless he wanted it to. But he got a reputation right then in the press. They thought he was a coward and hiding from something, and that really upset them. So the rest of the gang in Chicago immediately went to the press. They brought three appeals, which couldn't go anywhere because he wasn't convicted. He had pled guilty, and they didn't pursue him, but they could claim that this he was railroaded and try to cover up what had actually happened. Everybody knew that he framed himself, but they thought it was cowardice and didn't understand what really happened. There was one gang of the Aola brothers. There was six of them, and what happened in Prohibition is beer became very expensive because you had to move such huge quantities to get the same amount of highs that it became expensive, and people went to wine. So even though the wineries in California were shut down, they grew twice as much grapes, and they shipped them to Italian neighborhoods where they all had made it at home. And the Aola brothers, that's all they did, is every day they dropped off the equipment and the things they baked with, and picked up the containers with the wine, mixed it, and sold it to the restaurants, to the speakeasies and individuals. Well, there was a war going on with the Aola brothers, and I can't remember the name of the oldest, but he went to hide out in Buffalo under the Godfather there. A week after Capone went to jail, the whole gang got the message. Instead of hiding out, he moved back. Aola moved back to Chicago with his family, walked the streets, went back into competition, And there was no more killings that whole year that Capone was in jail.
Let's jump back to Mo Dalitz for a second. He's, of course, as you described him, he's one of the founding fathers of what was organized crime during the Prohibition period. He becomes a pillar of the community in Las Vegas. He's involved in many of the casinos that established the gaming industry here. You know, my colleagues, Bob Stodall and Ned Day, guys you knew, they had painted a picture of Mo Dalitz that, according to some of his colleagues, that in some ways he was sort of a victim of organized crime. You know, he went straight when he came to Nevada, but he could never quite shake those associations, that he might have been a victim of extortion in some ways, that and then eventually Las Vegas, Nevada, became sort of schizophrenic about its past and tried to cleanse itself, and Mo was sort of cast aside. What do you say about that?
Well, the reason these people talked to me, because they absolutely were tight-lipped. They made it clear to me, because with five different guys I was interviewing, they said something to me that made them look really bad. And I was just trying to get the truth, not to embarrass anybody. And in all five cases, I said to them, you do realize that what you said to me makes you look very bad. If you want to tell me it's off the record, I will never repeat it. And all five of them said to me the same thing. My whole life, I was involved with a form of crime, and I was looked at by the society as a criminal, and my family was. I came here, I'm legitimate, I do everything legal and right, and yet the stigma goes on. I'm talking to you because I want the truth. You can use that, but tell the whole truth. And that is, I hit the right time when these guys were just fed up, because it was the past they were being written about, not what they were doing today.
There's a guy you mentioned in the book, and this was maybe the most astonishing of all the interviews you got, at least to me, because he's another one of those that I reached out to a couple of times over the years. I never got anywhere. He's known, best known as Jimmy Blue Eyes. His name is Vincent Allo. If people will remember the movie Godfather 2, which was Best Picture, there was a Hyman Roth character who was based on Meyer Lansky, and then his chief aide was a guy named Johnny Ola. He was the one who took Fredo to Cuba. If you think of Johnny Ola and you reverse the letters in the last name, it's Allo, and that's who this guy was. Major figure, and you had many conversations with him. That's just an incredible get.
And here again, it has nothing to do with you or me, because, you know, my respect for you. What happened was, I was, the fact to this day, very close to his two grandsons. They liked what I was doing. Every so often they'd ask him if he'd talk to me, and he said no. Finally, one day I got a phone call at midnight, and they were all celebrating. He was visiting, had just arrived. They were celebrating, and they said he'll see at 9 a.m. tomorrow. And so we had the first interview, and after years of going after him, he was 91 at the time and totally alert. Tremendous mind, incredible sense of humor, as many of these guys did. And he, I finally said at the end of the interview, you've rejected my requests all these years. Why are you talking to me? And this was the edge you didn't have, because you didn't hit him at the right moment. He said, because everybody I know is dead. You're the only person left who knew the people I knew, who lived in the culture I lived in. You're the only person that understands me. And besides, you've got some great stories, too.
What was the biggest surprise you got out of him, something you didn't know before that's in the book?
I can't remember anything specific, but he was, you know, he and Mo's associates, they filled me in on all this stuff and gave me perspective. On the specifics, I can't tell you. Can I interject something here?
Sure.
You had said you met gangsters and didn't recognize them, and I think one important thing I learned that is wrong with the movies and all, I am to this day close friends with two men, and I interviewed the third man who's now gone. And what they did is any gangster in the country that wanted to open a bar, a restaurant, or a nightclub, one of them was known in the press as the architect of the mob. He designed it for him. Another man, he had a furnishing place, and he decorated the public area and supplied all the kitchen and bar equipment free of charge, and then he would charge them a high fee every month in interest. And the third one did the marketing, and they worked between us. We talked about it, not as a group, but me individually. We probably worked with one of us knew at least every major hood in America. And I talked with them, and the first thing I said, because they had good businesses without the mobsters, I said, why did you work for the gangsters? And they all said the same thing. They always paid, they were less demanding and more appreciative. But the movies show them being nothing but bullies. They look bad when they walk in public to back people off. They look bad in mugshots. Most of them were very honorable with those they needed to deal with. I'm not suggesting you go befriend them, because except for the gamblers, they can take very big advantage. But if they like you, if they know you, if they give you your word, not one of them ever got beat. But here was the interesting thing. All three guys said, there wasn't one mobster I knew that I couldn't take home to dinner with my family, and they would have thought they were a criminal. Exactly your experience, the way they behave in the movies, the way they're written about in the books, when you're with them and you're part of them, they are no different than anybody else you deal with.
Things did change, Bill. It changed here in Las Vegas, though, and then you know, we're jumping ahead of ourselves. That might be your next book, but as you remember, in the 70s, mid-70s, late-70s, things went south as the people of Mo Dalitz's vintage sort of withdrew from the industry, retired, sold out, and moved out. The Chicago interests came in, street violence, street crime, they had their own burglary ring. It all changed. It's sort of in the same kind of changes that those guys like Mo Dalitz, who would never break their vows and spill any secrets, all these mobsters, these modern mobsters, spilled the beans every time they get pinched for anything. And then the emergence of people like John Gotti, who had none of the honor of these kind of guys that you're talking about. What was it that changed here in Las Vegas? Why did things go south?
What changed here is, remember, when Prohibition started, most of the guys we're talking about were roughly 20 years old. They didn't start as bosses, but they were roughly 20. And those that survived, which was virtually everyone that I write about except for Siegel, when they were about 70 years old, around 1970, they started selling. At that point, Chicago had been here, but there was the other three groups that dominated and were the big ones and kept control. And Chicago, of course, a part of it was they had to respect what the other guys said, and part of it was they had licenses. You know, they had people from Chicago that had licenses, and they couldn't get in trouble or they'd lose it. And at that point, all these guys started selling out, and Chicago had taken control of the Teamsters Pension Fund. So they started buying up some of these places, and as casino operators, we know they skim, but as operators, I can't remember that they were any more problem than anyone else. But as you said, Tony Spilotro came to town. We had always had street crime, but he organized it. It was violent, for the first time, we had what the mobs like in other cities. You having lived here, anyone that I've known that lived in Vegas before 1980 will say the city was a lot better when the mob was here than the corporations. Everybody, because I was living here at that time, a long time, in other cities it sounded crazy because the mob preyed on people. They were awful, but these were gamblers, and they protected the people. That protection was now gone. Chicago was a different breed. Times had just changed. As you said, they were squealing on each other. It was just a different group, and they let Spilotro in, and he was a nightmare like this city never saw.
You were a casino operator at the height of the bad stuff that was going on with his hole-in-the-wall gang, and the skimming exposés that came out gave Las Vegas a terrible black eye. I can imagine that the stigma spilled over into legitimate joints as well. Everybody was tarred with the same brush, right? To some degree.
I don't remember any problems. In that way, you know, my places were run real clean. The state knew it, so I didn't have any problems or any imagery that way that I was aware of. Spilotro, just to give you one thing on him, even though he was the street crime rather than casino, he used to go into places even though he was on the blacklist, and I've seen things written like he was a Neanderthal. He didn't get it. Well, it was real simple. He only went into places that had Teamsters loans, and he had a very simple opinion. You license my money, you license me, because he was very big in the pension fund. But in my places, I'll give you an example of his behavior. The Silver Slipper, for 11 years, I had the number one sold-out show in town. Not one of his people ever showed up there. My security was aware of, you know, you tell me if anything's going on. Never showed up there. Everybody but Spilotro, who's blacklisted, bet at the Castaway Sportsbook. They all walked in, made their bets, left. None of them ever stopped and ate, played keno, played tables. And one of the three brothers of Spilotro was a regular customer at our poker room, used an alias, and he knew our rules. When he had played the right number of hours, he'd go out and say, I either want a steak or I want breakfast. He never asked for anything he didn't deserve, never got into an argument, which often happens with losing players, never was a problem. And so they were absolutely perfect customers with me. You know, that was my experience.
Well, I knew those guys, got to know them a little bit, and you know, there was one persona that was that was existed on the street. They could be gentlemen other times and blend right in, and that's for sure. It was a problem for law enforcement and gaming enforcement, and there's always two sides to the story. Bill, 30 years, 30 illegal years to the Strip is the book. It is a massive undertaking. Congrats on getting it out. I can only imagine how long and how much work went into this thing.
It has been a tremendous effort. I loved every minute of it, and I hope that people will enjoy it.
And you still got one more to come? At least one?
Oh, yeah, I've got several. The next one will be the history, as you would expect it. I will start from the beginning of gaming in Nevada and go chronologically. I had to write this one because when I tried to write the chronological history and take each person and when they were licensed, go back to their background, you can't talk about Siegel or Lansky or any of these people without talking about the other ones, because they were constantly becoming partners with each other.
Yeah. Bill Friedman, thanks very much for joining us. I always enjoy it. I hope you'll come back. 30 Illegal Years to the Strip is the name of the book, and it's a great one for anyone who's interested in the history of the mob. We'll come right back with the Ganja Godfather, Toby Rogers, right after this.